Okay, let's begin.
Recording in progress.
Okay. Today is Monday, October 25th, 2021, and we're rolling. Yesterday's shiur, we were in a different world. Today we have to shift gears and come back to the Rebbetzin. A quick correction, which I think I made already, but Rabbi Wiener played for me the tape of my shiur, and I was confusing Uzi with Asi. Uzi Dayan, General Moshe Dayan's nephew, who also became a general, is a fabulous Jew, which is just amazing, because where did he come from? Where was he raised? I've heard him speak his understanding of Yiddishkeit, of Shabbat, of Tarat Mishpacha, Kol HaKavod. Asi Dayan, Zichrono Levracha, was Moshe Dayan's son. And I don't know if Vayiftach Hashem et pi aton, I don't want to give out grades here, but he caused a lot of harm. And I'll never forgive him. I was in the rabbinate 67, and I recall the heartache. All the rabbanim in the Hollywood area, Beverly Hills, etc., asked him not, he was, doing a movie, the Dayan name. And they said, please don't do it on Shabbos. All the kids in the day schools, the Talmud Torahs, are looking at you. And he said, I'm not a Jew, I'm an Israeli. And that was his answer. Okay, Meir Kahana called attention. It's Meir's Yahrzeit now, and a lot is being said about him. So Meir called our attention to that problem, and the problem is real. And a tremendous challenge. We can't get too angry. We have to be constructive. I saw Bnei Akiva in their latest Alon, which they give out on Friday. So they're dealing with Kima Kima, Hagulati Ta Kima Kama. What does Kima Kima mean? Stage by stage. I've given many lectures on this, not for now. But I was very impressed with the Alon, because it makes the very point I've made in class so many times, and so many times in talks around the world, that we don't realize the miracle of what's happened here in the world of Torah, Talmud Torah. And Kima Kima, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you went to school here, your Rebbeim were big Lamdanim, but they weren't Zionists. They were from the Haredi world. At the most, they were not anti, but great understanding of Theodor Herzl and what happened here they did not have. Today you can have Rebbeim Gedolei Yisrael and their Tzionim Datiyim Belei V'Nefesh, and with the whole system that built up, the yeshiva high schools, the Hezdi yeshiva, the Pre-Ami yeshiva, the Ulpanot for girls, the Mechlalot for women, and Baruch Hashem, we're not there yet, but we've come a long way and we'll continue to move on. Kima, kima, b'ezrat Hashem. Okay, let's get back here. Jack Levenstein asked me an interesting question. What was the Rav's attitude towards Esther Jungreis? And here I alluded to something last week, which I just want to go a step further. There's no question that we'll see today Esther Jungreis. We'll see this today and next week. Her main thrust was emotion. And not everyone answers to emotion. The overwhelming majority of people, even the Rav, see, people had the attitude about the Rav that he's a brisk. The Rav would say, everyone believes that in brisk, there was no heart, only a mind. But he said, there was a heart, but they didn't show it publicly. And the Rav used the example of his father never kissed him. You've all heard this. And the Rav has been criticized, and Rav Moshe has been criticized. How can it be you never kissed your son? I don't know if you have to take it literally, but what the Rav was saying was that the deepest of emotions were done behind the curtain, behind the veil. And that was brisk. On the other hand, the Rav, as much as he was brisk, in the Yahrzeit Shiurim, in the Tshuva Drashot, he would reveal the most intimate matters between parents and children, husband and wife. He would break down and cry. So you see, I can still remember Pinchas Pelli apologizing to the Israeli public that in the middle of a tshuva drasha, the Rav said, if only I could speak to my father for a few more minutes. If only I could speak to my wife. It's very emotional. He describes how his wife would help him with preparing the drasha and what the ideas and what to use, what to be brief, what to elaborate. And the Israeli, I remember Pinchas Pelli writing, apologizing that the Israeli intellectual public may not understand this. So there's no question that someone who's kulo intellect and he's from Berkeley or Stanford, when you want to be makarif him, you have to bring in the Mor Nevuchim, you have to bring in the Kuzari, you have to bring in intellect. But the masses, what can I tell you? The heart, the tears, and that's where she was a master. Now, did the Rebbe ever talk about Rebbetzin and Esther Jungreis? I wasn't in America when Esther Jungreis broke on the scene. I was not in America. I'd have to ask Jay Solomon. Did the Rebbe ever talk about Esther Jungreis? And by the way, we express our condolences to Jay Solomon, the Red Sox. Did not make the World Series, so Hamakom Yenachem, that's all I can say. But that should be the worst tzah you should ever have. And but I want to tell you, open up the biography in Esther Jungreis, and I took it out this morning. I have to be honest with you, I wanted to be sure my memory is correct. I read the book, but I can't say that I read it. I went through the book like I go through a Daf Gemara. So this morning at about 4:15, when I already said Modani and washed, I pulled the book out and I checked. I was right. And in the book, let's see if I recorded the page. One second. Yeah, you can look in page 65. So in the book, the author writes, again, it's not a scholarly book. There are no footnotes. You have to depend that he didn't make it up. It's real. He said when Esther Jungreis was ready to rent the Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden, and we'll talk about it in detail, that was a turning point in her life. And her father was a little bit worried, how would the Gedol Yisrael accept this, a woman speaking, preaching in public, tens of thousands of people, how would the Gedol Yisrael accept this? So according to the volume, her father went to four Gedol Yisrael, and all four gave her a bracha that she should be successful. Who were the four? All right, if you go back to early 70s, I think it's 1973, these are exactly, yeah, it's 1973, number one Rabbi Yosef Elio Henkin. He was the most famous posek in America. He died 73, 74, I think it was 73 when he died at the end of the year. And he already was blind at that time, but you had to go to Rav Henkin. He gave his bracha. Then, of course, who did we speak about yesterday? Reb Moshe Feinstein. You have to go to Reb Moshe Feinstein. Then her father, Reb Avraham Jungreis, went to the Rav. And you got to remember, the youngest son, Brudi, Binyamin, Zichrono Livracha, who died from corona, he was a Talmud of YU. He was a Talmud of Reb David Lifshitz, actually. I understand that was his Rebbe Muvhak. And he had smicha from YU, so he went to Rav Jungreis, went to the Rav, and the Rav gave his bracha. And then when he already had Rav Henkin, Rav Moshe, and the Rav, he went to the Satma Ruv. I don't know how much the Satma was functioning. Charlie, if you recall, in 68 he had the stroke right after he published Ala Gula Vala Tamura, but his Gaboyim held him up. In other words, You see a Rebbe in the Litvisha world, lo aleinu, if you can't teach, if you can't speak, you got to sit back and retire. But in the Hasidic world, the Gaboyim can hold you up. You appear, you wave, you move your head. So I don't know how much the Satan was functioning, but according to the volume, he also gave a bracha. So, Jack, that answers your question. Now, coming back to Meir Kahane, I don't know if you're following all that's been written now. But I want to give you the exact quote. Rabbi Przanski was actually here yesterday, and Steve wrote to me, I recall hearing the following from Meir Kahana Hashem Yukom Domo. Once when he was arrested by the Israeli police, they manhandled him quite forcibly. He complained and said that even the New York City police never roughed him up that much. The Israeli officer replied, quote, this is not New York. Here we don't have to worry about the Jewish vote, end quote. And if you follow what's being written, the new book that I referred to last week is not totally negative. It does say that Kahana, his extremism did not catch on. But the questions that he raised are very real. As I've said in class, these are questions that you can't escape unless you're, you know, totally believe Judaism doesn't count and all that counts is democracy. If you're a merits person or an avodah lo aleinu, what happened to the Labor Party here? And to them, there's no Jewish question. It doesn't enter the ballpark. But anyone beyond that, these are real problems. So the book was not entirely anti. But nevertheless, it portrays Kahana as an extremist and doing things beyond the letter of the law, etc. And blowing up a hura, you know, salbi hura. That is a black mark in Kahana's record. There's nothing you can do about it. A woman was killed, Ira Kunis. So I saw that my Talmud, Seth Sackett, wrote a tremendous article that appears on a Rosh Yeshiva. I don't know if it's published. Maybe it'll be published in Besheva. And he rips the heck out of the book and he says, even though my Rebbe is dead 31 years, my Rebbe is Meir Kahana. I wish he would have also said, but the one that got me started was Aaron Rakefet. I'm a BMT. I'm the one who got him started. All right, Meir. Meir is Meir. Kalak Habot. But all right, that debate will rage on, and 100 years from now we may have a better evaluation, but I stand on what I said in my lectures, and I thank the people. I've gotten some compliments from very intelligent people around the world. I believe I've portrayed Meir accurately, and I probably knew Meir a lot better than Seth Sackett and many others. I knew him, you know, as a kid. We grew up together, we worked together. And then I taught his entire family, and it's a deep connection. And Meir is Meir. My best story, I think I told you, was with Rabbi Lookstein when he was in a halfway house, and he was Friday night. He was allowed to leave to go to religious services, so he was someplace in Manhattan near within walking distance of Kilat Yeshurun, KJ. And he called Rabbi Lookstein, this is Hacky Lookstein already, Haskell, and he asked Hacky if he'd be his guest Friday night. And Hacky said, of course, Audrey, Hacky, and they got all the kids, four children, excited. And when Mayor walked in, they expected some guy to walk in with horns and guns. And a nice, good Jewish boy walks in with Derek Eretz. They had a lot of trouble realizing this is Meir Kahana. Because the way the New York Times described him, they figured some terrorist is going to come in. Okay, regarding Golda Meir, I have to thank Jay Solomon for the exact quote. We can forgive the Arabs for killing our children. We cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children. We will only have peace with the Arabs when they love their children more than they hate us. And that's a very powerful statement. I also want to say, and here I thank Stewie Polachowski, my student. In a million years, I wouldn't know this. I quoted the New York Times that the New York Times called Esther Jungreis a Jewish Billy Graham. And I asked the class, do you know who Billy Graham was? And no one knew, the evangelistic preacher, etc. But one kid said Bill Graham, something with music. Do you know that he was right? Do you know that Bill Graham was the most successful rock and roll concert promoter during the 60s and the 70s on both the East and West Coast? He was Jewish. He escaped Nazi Germany. He wound up in a foster home in the Bronx. And I went to Google. You can't believe his life story. A Jewish boy running away from Hitler, raised in the Bronx in a foster home. Fairly assimilated, as you can imagine. But I'll tell you, when he came back to his Jewish roots, and he was widely quoted. In 1985, the Bitburg controversy. Does anyone remember that? President Reagan went to the cemetery in Germany to place a wreath at the Bitburg's World War II cemetery. And there was a tremendous Jewish outcry. I remember friends of mine demonstrated, very important people, world famous people, Jewish people, not from, demonstrated against Reagan because there were SS soldiers buried in that very cemetery. And there's where you're going to lay your wreath. And Bill Graham came out publicly with all this prestige in the music world. He came out publicly and fought Reagan in public. He died young. He was killed in a helicopter crash in 1991 when returning from a Huey Lewis and the News concert at Concord Pavilion, whatever that was. But I have to apologize to the student who didn't know Billy Graham. And remember, he said, Bill Graham, music, and all of us laughed, and the joke is on us. Okay.
Elie Wiesel told Reagan, not to go.
Well, I know a lot of people told him not to go.
I think he told him to his face. Good.
Yeah, no, Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan was an Ohev Yisrael, but you get caught up in, Putin too is an Ohev Yisrael, but you get caught up in world politics.
My father-in-law, Shalom, who was a survivor and a partisan, he said something like, he likes seeing Nazi graves.
In other words, Reagan likes thinking, all right, there's something to that too. Now, I want to say I caused a bit of a controversy, and I have endless emails here about Rudolf Kastner. Now, the truth is I've lectured extensively. It's not for now. Again, I have to hope that one day Barack will take off 49 years and listen to the shirm that are available on whyutorah.org. And Rudolf Kastner, I have to make it clear, you're dealing here with a very controversial person. What did he do? Why did he do it? I got letters from people whose grandparents, they claim, were killed as a result of Kastner. Why? And this all came up in the trial with Grunwald. See, they accused Kastner of knowing that the Germans intended to kill every last Jew in Hungary. But part of the deal was they'll let him save some Jews, but he can't tell them what their ultimate plans are. Others accused Kastner by giving them money and giving them trucks. They were able to send Jews away on these trucks, and they had money yet. We'll never know the whole truth. I have to tell you, the man Kisko Rav, who wrote the book, who was the big inspiration for Ben Hecht, and wrote the book that they wouldn't allow into Israel, telling his story, Rabbi Weissmandel. It's been translated into English. I think Artscroll put it out, or Masorah, with their branch that does the history books. He wanted to buy Jews out, and who knows what Kastner thought in his mind. It could be that he figured the Nazis are going to do what they want anyway. Let me save whatever I can. At this moment, I have the ability to save almost 2,000 Jews, or slightly more than 2,000. It's a tremendous question. We'll never know the full truth, and we'll never know black and white if we can say he did wrong, he did right. And you have to realize, looking back now, the majority, I would say a substantial percentage of the frum Jews in the world today are a result of being saved by Kastner. Just take the Satmarov. how many people did the Satmaruv influence? Just think for a minute. You're talking hundreds of thousands of Jews who identify with Satma. And if I'm exaggerating, but put together from 1946 until today, it's not an exaggeration. Some are dead already, but there's a whole new generation. Satma is the biggest Jewish educational system in the United States. Statistics show it doubles itself every 8 years. Just think what I'm telling you. It doubles itself every 8 years. Doesn't mean every last one is a Satma. There are plenty of good Zionists there. And Rakefet, I once had a tremendous debate with Rabbi Shalom Gold. He maledicted, he cursed Satma. Wow. And I said, they're our greatest source of future Balei Tshuva. To turn them into real Jews. I said, we have to reach out to them. And I am proud to tell you that from this little classroom and being totally ignored by YU, I have had some influence in Satma. I have to tell you, I have students there, I get regular emails there, and Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. So, the Satma Rav. Now, I'm not taking any sides. Believe me, if I want to say something negative about Kastner, I just look at his granddaughter, our prime minister, who we just praised 20 minutes ago, made her into one of the great gurus of Israel at this moment in time in 2021. And Meirav Micheeli, an understanding of what it means to be a Jew, a mouse who runs around Jerusalem running away from cats, has more understanding of Yiddishkeit than Meirav Micheeli. So there's a lot to be negative, but it's a big question mark. I can tell you I had conversations with the Rav, and Rebbe is sitting right here. I had conversations with the Rav on a very serious issue. It was the last time I saw the Rav face to face, 1983. And that day he was quite with it. And I was in his apartment. Little did I dream that many years later, YU would put me up in that very apartment when they honored me. God, what you see in life is unbelievable. And I remember a Rosh Yeshiva said to me, Reb Aaron, you're not afraid to be in the apartment of the Rav? I said, well, don't scare the heck out of me. I'm there with my wife. Let me relax. Wow. And he was right. When I thought about it, I should have been very frightened. I was sitting on the very furniture. Nothing was new. You know, why he was not that wealthy. Nothing was new. It was the very furniture that the Rav sat on, that the Rav used. And I raised the issue with the Rav of the Kovner Rav, of Ravim Dovbek, Ahana Shapiro. Ravram Dovbik, Ahana Shapiro, was the Rav's masmich. I mean, who are we talking about? The famous letter who the Rav was that Rav Moshe used to show around, Rav Moshe, his father, that letter is by the Kovner Rav, the Dov Avraham. And in the Holocaust, he was mater in 1942 to give the names of the people in Kovner who are too ill to work, who don't work, to the Gestapo. Now, what does it mean? These people were going to be sent away a few days later to extermination. Right or wrong? And I raised the issue with the Rav, and I've published on it. I published a major work in tradition. Later it's in Rakafet Arum. And I can't go into all details. Now I want to stick to my lecture. But I can only tell you, the Rav said to me, and if we were there, I don't know what we would have decided. These questions you can't think out totally, halachically, logically, rationally. It's under the pressure of the moment. I don't know if we would have decided any differently. And by the way, I come up with a tremendous chiddush to justify the Kovner Rav, and I have to tell you, Rav Asher Weiss, 1 month later, lectured on the topic and quoted exactly the sources I came up with, the Chetuvit, Beit Jacob, etc. It's not for now, but it's in Rekafet Aaron, either. I think it's in Chelik Bet, if I'm not mistaken. Now, so when it comes to Kastner, I don't want to make any statement of judgment. The issue has to hang fire. But one thing I can tell you, the Satmaruv should have been Makatoiva to Kastner. And there's a tremendous, if you read about literature on the Satmar Rebbe, those that critique him, one of the biggest critiques is that they ask the Satmar Rav, "Nu vechat eich geratavit, who saved you?" And the Satmar Rav said, "The Eibishta, the Ribbono Shel Olam." And the people asking him dug him and said, "All right, you're right, the Ribbono Shel Olam, we all agree, but who is the agent?" And he wouldn't answer. "The Jewish agency, Kastner." Okay. And I can tell you, in 63 years of teaching, I was cut off a few times in the middle of my talk. One time I told you Reb Moshe Feinstein's daughter, the greatest compliment they ever gave my life. And sometimes I was cut off, not with a compliment. Machon Gold, the father, was sitting in my shir in Kibbutz Hadati. I'm going back now to the early 70s. And I quoted the Satmar Rav, and the person yelled out, "Yamach Shmo v'zichro." And Charlie, I didn't get offended. I continued. After the lecture, I called him. I said, "I know why you said that. You know, you understand. It's obvious why you said it." And he said, "Of course. His father asked the Satmar Rav, should they go in Aliyah? And the Satmar Rav, this is in 36, Chas v'chalila, you become a goy in Palestine." And needless to say, the father was killed by Hitler. And there are endless stories like this. But this whole issue, this whole area, I have to say, I reserve judgment until I know all the facts. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam can give judgment on it. So I apologize to anyone I offended, but I feel we have to be makatoiva. And I come back to the question of why in that volume nothing was mentioned about Kastner saving the Jungreis family. So I have to thank Miriam Kupski, and Mrs. Miriam Kupski. Anyone recognize the name? I checked out who she is. She emailed me listening to the Shiurim. She teaches in some of the high schools. She has a master's from Bernard Revel, raised in Brooklyn in a Hasidic home, Broughton, and she's a student of Torah history. And she wrote to me that she was at a lecture many years ago on the Kastner train at the Heritage Museum in Lower Manhattan, you know, down near Battery Park. There's the Jewish Heritage Museum. And one of the main speakers was Rabbi Jungreis, the Rebbetzin's brother. Now, she's not certain if it's the older one or the younger. I told her it has to be the older one, who's still, as far as I know, he's still alive. He's the eldest. He's about 3-4 years older than I am. And Miriam, Esther is gone. She died at the age of 80. And Binyamin died, I think he was 79, a year ago, from the first round of the Corona Loa Menu. So Momoshu was her older brother. He was very grateful to Kastner. And obviously, as an invited speaker on the topic, was not interested in admitting this fact from his life. Lehefech, he spoke forcibly and powerfully about the family's sojourn on the train and their subsequent arrival in America. So my question hangs fire: why in this biography, and with all due credit to Art Scroll or Masorah Publication for publishing it, why did the author leave that out? My question hangs fire. If anyone meets Rabbi Seltzer, he lives in Beit Shemesh, I'm told, I'd appreciate if you would ask him if what was behind it, because it's very disjointing to read, here they are on a train going to Bergen-Belsen, and a minute later they're in Switzerland. And why? How? Explain. Okay. Now, let me go further. It's a fabulous topic to try to understand Rebbetzin Jungreis. And the world still awaits a definitive PhD thesis It's a lot of facts that you can gain from I would call it the persona of Rebbetzin Jungreich's book. A lot more has to be added. Okay, she has to be seen in context. So what did we talk about last week? We spoke about, first of all, the family, Hungary, where she comes from, who her father was, the greater Jungreich family, all the Rabbanim. We spoke about World War II in Bergen-Belsen, where they were for a brief time, because then they were diverted to the Kastner train. And the Shabbat, remember the crumbs of bread, the ability to keep joy, to keep Shabbat, right? Gam ki yelech, we gave some of it. By the way, that ties in with yesterday's shiur, with what I cited from Reb Menashe Klein. I told you that paragraph is widely cited. No one else could have written it. Not Reb Moshe Feinstein, not Reb Avadji Yosef, but Reb Menashe Klein, that look how they smuggled and tefillin into the death camps, even though they knew that the tefillin would later be destroyed if caught. Chas v'chalila, people would be killed, but they were mice and nefesh for the tefillin. And that's like the crumbs of bread, the same concept. And then we dealt with the story of Yaakov, who we just spoke about, how he risked his life jumping over the fence, going to get the diapers and the medicine for the baby who was born, go and dream that that baby whose life he saved would one day become the Tzelem HaRav. By the way, I received a letter, again, one of the emails, people listening, and they said, you're absolutely correct, the story's correct, but there's a sad reality today. He is the Tzelem HaRav, and he has no children. In other words, here he is hitting 80, and he has no children. So it'll be interesting to see if the dynasty continues. Now, there's something else about the Rebbetzin that becomes part of her portfolio, and this too sheds light on who we're talking about, where she's coming from. And I have to tell you, this brings us right down to the whole question Meir Kahana asked: democracy versus Judaism. And it's very simple, and I've used this very effectively. I have to tell you, in my years in the army, in my lectures, I was able to use this very effectively. And you take the Western world. What is the Western world? The Western world has no past, doesn't care. Right now they're knocking down statues, they're taking, recreating history. Remember my talk of this a year and a half ago? It's one of the best talks I ever gave on Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu. We're not ashamed of our past. We built on it. We came. We respect the past. But you see, when you have no past, you don't give a hoot about the future. What does democracy say to you? What does the New York Times say to you? What does Meirav Michaeli say to you? I'm here now. All that counts is me now, here. Wine, women, song. Tomorrow we may die. It's the whole thrust on the world you're living in. God have mercy. Jews have been in the headlines these last few years. Weinstein, Epstein. I don't have to elaborate. What is the message that it tells you? All that counts, wine, women, and song. Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the future. That's the antithesis of what Yiddishkeit is all about, what Torah is all about. And the Rav used to say, and I'll never forget this, and it's so true, that the average little Jewish kid in Cheder knows Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak Avinu, Yaakov Avinu, Sarah Rivka Rachel Leah. It's more real to him then you go into any school in the world and you mention Socrates, Plato. You don't know what you're talking about. For us, this is the past is real. Well, if the past is real, then you're concerned for the future. We want to be sure we're here tomorrow, that they're Jews tomorrow. And this is the heart of the difference. You go to North Tel Aviv. And I've been to North Tel Aviv, and I've been to weddings, and I give, by the way, the Tzohar Rabbanim credit. they perform weddings. You don't know the crowds you're dealing with. And but you have to strike. I used to say in the army, yes, the Western world, but we have blood. Prick yourself. Draw some blood. What is that blood? Who are you? Where do you come from? Where's your blood from? Don't you have responsibilities to those that came before you? And then you have to go a step further, that our forebears were Meiser Nefesh. Remember, if we remain Jews, I remember in graduate school, there was Professor Akis. I trust you've heard the name. These were legendary figures. Rene Agus and Avram Yitzchak Agus. And he used to carry on. There should be 100 million Jews in the world today. Where are they? Gone, assimilated, intermarried. Look at the Secretary of State of the United States today. That's a Jew? Look who he's married to. Where are his kids being educated? Look at the President of the United States. All his kids are married to Jews. Those are Jews? Look who he appoints. Look what goes on. One Jew after another. Will there be anything left of them? Absolutely not. Unless Chabad reaches them or NCSY. I mean, we got to be honest. Ribbono shel Olam. And the Jew that we remain Jews. Mesiret nefesh lech teichacharei b'midbar yeretz lo sarua. Koama Hashem. Zachati la chesed nurayach. Don't forget it. Don't forget it. Rabbi Wiener, Holyoke, Massachusetts. No, let's understand where you come from and how you got here. Baruch Hashem. The Rebbetzin was very powerful. And here I quote to you from the volume, beginning on page 595. The Rebbetzin never let her children forget where they came from. The Rebbetzin had a collage made of all their ancestors, all their forebears. Beautiful collage. Rabbanim after Rabbanim after Rabbanim. At every simcha in the family, she would walk in. Everyone knew the Rebbetzin came in. A big bag was with her. The family has arrived. All the svarim of the Zetas put out on the table. You understand what this means? It's osmosis. You don't have to say a word. But the Zetas are here at the Simcha. The Rebbetzin spoke. The Zetas are here. They're on the table. And this was part of her persona. She would make a grand entrance, carrying the bag. No one could carry it for her. And one by one, the Zetas are here. She would use this very effectively when she spoke as well. And I need not tell you, this already is partially emotion, partially intellectual, but the blood in your veins, who are you? Where did you come from? Who gave you life? The generations before you, don't spit in their faces and throw them away under the wheels of the train. All right? Now, when she started to go public, and we'll come to this in great detail. It all begins with the shul in North Woodmere. My conclusion is, unless anyone will correct me, that it was a regular shul looking for a young rabbi, a shul that was starting up. Are you going into the rabbinate? Okay. So this story of North Woodmere reminded me when I came to Maplewood. Someone sent me a link, I told you. They interviewed the original founders of the shul in North Woodmere about the shul and about the Rebbetzin. It was done a few years ago. And it was just like Maplewood. Maybe one or two families were really Shomer Shabbos when it began. And they were looking for a rabbi. And she had four young children yet. She couldn't become a world personality. But Yomo did a Google search for me. And I would estimate this is Young Israel, of the famous Young Israel of Woodmere, Rabbi Heschel Billet, who just came in Aliyah. Rabbi Shai Schachter is there, if I'm not mistaken, today, among other Rabbanim. It may be one of the biggest Young Israels in the world, if not the biggest. This is where they were, Congregation Or Torah of North Woodmere. To me, it would appear to be about a 25-minute walk. Vic, you have relatives there? Would you agree about 25 minutes? Okay, that's where they began. But they began, you're talking at a time when the five towns were not yet the five towns, Young Israel of Woodmere. In other words, you were beginning not Yesh Meayin, but Yesh from Half Ayin, okay? Now, later, the Madison Square affair, that pushed the Rebbetzin into the limelight. And from that point on, Hineni was born. Again, I'm pronouncing it the way it should be pronounced, although people generally say Hineni. They say Hineni ha'ani mimas. I mean, it fits in either way. But Hineni is from the Pasuk with Avraham and Yitzchak. So then the Rebbetzin moves. Basically, her main classes were being given on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. There she attracted an element already that had means. And they went and bought a building that still functions until today. Jay Solomon filled me in that her daughter, she has one daughter, Rebbetzin Wolf, who's very powerful and very good, like the mother. And that building, I'll give you the exact address, 232 Western Avenue. It was Western Avenue between 70th and 71st Street, the heart of the Upper East Side. And here, too, we got the building, the Upper West Side, I should say, thank you. And here's the building. It's like a 3-4-story little building between typical West Side houses, and that was the focal place for her lectures. Okay, now I want to shift gears, and I want to take an example what this is all about. Let's follow it, let's feel it, let's see it, let's experience it. And here we're very blessed. We have a in-depth story, autobiography. A volume appeared in the year 2000, From Central Park to Sinai, authored by Roy Neuberger. Subtitle, How I Found My Jewish Soul. Shlomo, I had the privilege of not only knowing the Jungreises, but knowing the Neubergers as well. And here with the Neubergers, you have a typical American, well-to-do, assimilated family, raised ethical culture. Do you know what ethical culture is about? I taught Jomo the other morning when I was preparing the lecture. This was prepared years ago, but going through ready to give it. Ethical culture, where I was rabbi in Maplewood, South Orange, the shul I built from the ground, First Orthodox Shul, suburban Essex County, I'm proud of it. Believe me, I'm proud of it. And if anyone would have told me back in 62 that one day there'll be a state-of-the-art mikveh in Maplewood and an Erev, I would have said, you are crazy. Called the loony bin. But Baruch Hashem, that's what you have there today. So, ethical culture, the corner of Parker and Prospect. We're in a suburb of Newark now, okay? From Parker and Prospect to walk to Newark was a 15-minute walk. Springfield Avenue, you're over the border, you're in Newark. So that corner was zoned for houses of worship. One corner you had a church, a Protestant church, I don't know, Episcopalian, something like that. The other corner, directly across from the church, was Beth Ephraim, my shul. Across from us, on the other side, was Ethical Culture. Ethical Culture was founded by a Reform rabbi. His name, Yomo? No, Felix Adler. No, say it, Felix Adler. Felix Adler, who was Felix Adler? His father was a rabbi, a Reform rabbi from Germany. Temple Emanuel sent him to Europe to get rabbinic ordination. There were no rabbinic schools yet in America. And he came back, he was going to be the next rabbi of Temple Emanuel. Not a small matter, Temple Emanuel, Ein Kleinigkeit. The heart, the bastion of Reformed Judaism. And he becomes the assistant rabbi, and he gets up from the pulpit and says, "Zot haTorah she'asam Moshe lifnei b'nei Yisrael." I cannot accept this. It cannot be only for the Jewish people. We gave the world, and there's no such thing as Judaism anymore. It's a world religion of ethics and morals. And he walked off the platform and established Ethical Culture. No different than the woman at the wall. Rabbi Twesky sent me a video where the woman is making the bracha, Bachabanu im kol ha'amim. Im kol ha'amim. All right, this is Ethical Culture. And what would hurt me is Ethical Culture, first of all, during the week, they had projects of chesed. They went into the Newark ghetto with the Afro-American children and helped them adjust the school, gave out food to the needy. Sunday morning, they would meet a service. What does it mean, a service? There's no God in Ethical Culture. But they would read from the Old Testament, the New Testament, words of wisdom. Something from the Talmud, something from Socrates, something from Plato, something from Shakespeare. That's Ethical Culture. What used to hurt me, it was 99% Jewish. It was just unbelievable. All the Jews from Newark, La Brioute, that their grandparents were Shema Torah and Mitzvot, conservative reform was too Jewish for them, and they were in Ethical Culture.
Did they relate to God? And also, is that what they call the Ethical Culture Society?
Yeah, that's the Ethical Culture Society. Did they relate to God? As far as I know, they had no belief in God. In other words, you could believe in God, but it wasn't essential to be part of the Ethical Culture. I don't think there was any worship service. It was just readings. I hope today in Ethical Culture, they read from Washington. Got it? I hope. I don't know. Yomo, check it out for me. Or read from Bernard Revel, or the Silver Era, or the Rav, or something from Rakafan Aron. Ethics, morals are there. Why not?
Yeah, big schools on the west side.
Western. And Jewish, how many, what percentage Jews? I would say in Essex County was more than 90% at least Jews. And that's the way Roy and his wife, later Leah, that's the way they were raised. And the story of how they meet the Rebbetzin, very important to hear how she tells the story. I'm reading now from page 13, the introduction foreword by Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis. In the early years of our Hineni organization, I was lecturing at a hotel in the Catskills when I was approached by one of the guests. Rebbetzin, you must go to Newburgh. Now, I'll tell you, Newburgh, New York, I went and looked up, I wanted to understand where they were, where Newburgh was, we'll come to it. Newburgh, New York, it's upstate New York, and this lady comes over to her. There is a congregation there that is in turmoil, and I really believe that your speaking there could make a significant difference. As a young girl, my father taught me never to ignore such messages. Rabbi Avraham Jungreis said to her, quote, you never know whom you could reach, whom you could touch. Now, I have to say there's a very important message here. What's your first name?
Natan.
Right? I got it. Natan. You know, sometimes you have to make a cheshbon. Is it worth the effort? Okay. So let me tell you a story. I think I write this in Washington. Is it absolute, every syllable true? I worked very hard when I was younger. I had infinitely more strength than I had today. And I was in the rabbinate. I was a rebbe in YU, was a Rosh Yeshiva. I had talmid and gave a shir. I'm still like this with many talmidim from 55 years ago. So one Thursday night, they asked me, they want to have a dialogue at the Y of Irvington, New Jersey. Irvington was adjacent to Maplewood, also adjacent to Newark. So I would be the Orthodox rabbi, there would be the conservative rabbi, Teddy Friedman, who was world famous, president of the Rabbinical Assembly, and there'd be a Reform rabbi. I said, all right, fine. And I went and I spoke. That's the famous talk I gave. Well, again, I can't repeat it. It's in Washington with the parking lot. You're a Catholic rabbi. What I did to Teddy Friedman, etc., etc. I came home 12 midnight. And my wife says to me, you know, you're working too hard. What did you do? You spoke. You entertained. All right. There were hundreds of people there, of course. A debate, Orthodox, conservative, Reform, you know, it's like Joe Louis versus Joe Volkoff, like a boxing match. So hundreds of people. What did you do? You're exhausted. You taught today at yeshiva. You got to get ready for Shabbos. You have to... I want you to know, one couple, I can tell you, was there at that dialogue, and when I hit Teddy Friedman with the Catholic rabbi, it pushed them over the cliff. And they not only went on to become Balei Tshuva, but they came in Aliyah. There must be hundreds of direct descendants of theirs. They had a very big family, and the children, and Frum, and the grandchildren, and the great-grandchildren. I don't even know if they're alive today. Lost contact. But wow, what you accomplish. And sometimes, you know, you get a request. Don't ask, there's going to be a million people there, they're going to give me $1,000. Sometimes, even if there are 10 people, you may change the world. So the Rebbetzin went. And the Rebbetzin had a, we'll come to this woman too in more detail, Barbara Janoff, I knew her too, I met her also. She ran the Rebbetzin. The Rebbetzin needed some full time to run her schedule, to make the arrangements. This was a college professor who gave it all up to become the Rebbetzin's right hand. Very sophisticated, intelligent woman. And Barbara protested to her, it's a long drive, it's a waste of time. You won't have more than a dozen people. You can't run every time someone tells you to go somewhere. This is real life. I'm not trying to over-dramatize. This is real life. I admit today people invite me to speak. I say anyone who wants to hear me speak has to come to Chris. All right, today I have a big crowd in front of me on the screen, but I don't have the energy. But when I was younger, I would take every last invitation. So she comes to the shul in Newburgh. I don't know whether it was an Orthodox shul, a conservative shul. If anyone from Newburgh knows the background, fill me in, because the book does not give the background, and neither does the Newburgh book. And she says, surprisingly, The synagogue was full. It was packed. There wasn't a seat to be had. I spoke from my heart about the meaning of our Judaism, our history, our faith, our covenant. The response was electric and inspiring. Now, what does that mean, electric and inspiring? Yeah, people hear a sermon. Believe me, I've preached all over the world. And sometimes I really hit the crowd. Wow, Melbourne, Sydney, Cape Town, Johannesburg, Toronto, Montreal, U.S., coast to coast, Israel, Army. I've been all over the world. I yet was in Africa, in Sinai, Lebanon, Rebbeinu Lailam, and you walk away, you think, yeah, the people are inspired, but unfortunately, we're all go back to the rut, what the prophet calls mitzvot anashim melumada. And they walk away, and the next day, it's a distant memory already. Ah, Rakefet, nice guy, good message. Wonderful, glad that we have him. But you have no influence whatsoever. And halacha l'maisa. And then there's one family that you changed their world and call him a kayim nechvesh achas. It's the whole world. You don't know what comes out of it. I mean, I'm overwhelmed. I'm going to dedicate my next publication to my Rebbe in eighth grade, Reb Chenoch Fishman, the Shanghai survivor. I was ready to go to Bronx High School of Science, the idiots in Bronx High School for 4 years. I would get letters from them. They thought I was going there. I was registered. I was this, that. And Reb Chenoch was the one who pushed me to go to MTA. And think what came out of it. We punished between my brothers and myself, and it's I'm the older brother. I'm the one who paced the way. We can't even count all the great grandchildren we have. We ani modela kadosh baruch hu. Have a brit tomorrow. I had a brit a few weeks ago. I had some girls, thank God, along the way, and I can't even count how many. Not enough fingers, not enough toes, not enough fingers again. Remember all the names. I never taught a class with as many students as Baruch Hashem. I have great grandchildren. So you don't know. You don't know one time, one Rebbe, one moment, and wow. Little did I realize, however, that the impact of that evening would reach far beyond the synagogue and would affect my life as well, for it was there that I met Roy and Linda Neuberger, who became major forces in the Hineni organization. Now, what happened was, and you'll hear Roy describe it himself. What happened was, he and Linda were moved. And they didn't know what to do. They were seeking, they were searching. They were late 20s, early 30s. And he sends a letter to the Rebbetzin. What can I do to follow up the talk I heard in Newburgh, in the synagogue in Newburgh? Rebbetzin writes back that the only way to follow up is to come learn, come study. And the Rebbetzin writes here, she figured it's a waste of time. There in upstate New York or upstate there in Connecticut, they really lived in a different area, but it was adjacent Connecticut, upstate New York. She's teaching at that time in Brooklyn. And worse than that, the year was 73, this you don't remember, the energy crisis. The Arabs cut off oil to the world. Do you remember that? It changed. This is one of the worst moments in the history of Israel that they introduced daylight savings time here. It was so wonderful to come to a country, no daylight savings time. You never had to worry about a minyan. You never had to worry about a lot hashacha. Everything was wonderful, good, and you didn't have to worry about changing a clock and losing an hour's sleep, gaining an hour's sleep. One of the most embarrassing moments of my life, and boy, they didn't let me forget it, was in my first shul, Lower Merian Synagogue, where I forgot to put the clock back for the winter, and I walked into Minyan, what was it, early, late, whatever happened, and they laughed at me, the Balab, a 23-year-old kid out of yeshiva. Wow, Shleimela, lo hayakol kach kach, nishgeven grin, got it? Whatever language you understand. And then they introduced daylight savings here because it saves money, it saves oil, etc. You don't have to have so much electricity. Who knows if it's true or not, but okay. So the Rebbetzin writes that she didn't believe anything would come of it. They're going to travel. Where are they going to get gas? You were rationed. Gas was limited. Do you remember what they introduced in Israel? Charlie, well, you had to be here. One day a week you couldn't use your car. And remember, you had to get a sticker. And the Shabbat sticker was beautiful. It was blue. Blue. That was beautiful. Techelet. Ach. One day a week. And the Mapanikim complained that the Shemesh Shabbos people shouldn't have to use their car 2 days a week, because they said they're not going to drive Shabbos anyway. So why do you save gas? But all right, it was a miracle day. But so she thought it would be a waste of time. Lo and behold, the family started coming to Flatbush, to Brooklyn, to her lectures. Not only did they start coming, they met the family, met the Jungreis family, became friendly with the Jungreis family, went to Israel on a trip with the Jungreis family, and ultimately they gave up their business, gave up their home, and moved to North Woodmere to be near the Jungreis family. And ultimately, their daughter married one of the Jungreis boys, Anshel Jungreis. They live in Bethel, if I'm not mistaken. Now, there's another point here. And this takes me back to my opening conversation with Barak. By the way, I apologize to everyone looking at me from the screen, but I have a classroom filled now in front of me, so you have to forgive me. I have to talk to those that are tangible, and then afterwards we'll deal with the screen. And you remember our open conversation? So what did you say to me? I asked you, your mother's from where? Your mother's from Chicago. And you told me you have big yichus through your mother, Reb Dov Tzvi Heller. And you fainted when the Rebbe could tell you exactly who Reb Dov Tzvi Heller was and who his sons-in-law were, etc., etc. All right, not every Reb Dov Tzvi Heller, Mashkiach in Slabotka, a giant. You know, he came in Aliyah. He died in Israel. I hope you know that. What yichus. So then I said to this young man, he tells me a story. How did he come from? How did we come from, all right, interesting story. We each have stories, how we became B'nai Torah. All right. He started learning Daf Yomi at the age of 15. And the story's not logical, so you remember what I told you? It's more than that. Your forebears are pleading with the Ribbono Shel Olam, Shelo Yidach Menu Nidach. Something has to remain. It shouldn't be entirely cut off, shouldn't be entirely lost. All right? Tell me, Roy and Linda turned to Rabbi Jungreis, and he became Rabbi Jungreis Sr., Rabbi Avram, not the husband, not Meshulam. He was also part of it. They revered the grandparents, and you know, Zaydi, and he gave them Hebrew names. Roy, Linda was named Leah. All right, that's easy. Roy became Yisrael. Shlomo, you know why he became Yisrael? He is a direct descendant of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Now, tie it together with what I told your good friend and my dear student, Barak. Got it, Barak? That Rabbi Yisrael pleaded with the Rebbe, give me, and this is miraculous. You're taking a family that knew absolutely nothing about Yiddishkeit and take a look who he comes from, who he descends from, and I'll tell you something else. Roy Newberg is related to the Rav by marriage. Can anyone tell me what I'm talking about? I don't know if he knew it. I don't know if the Rebbetzin knew it. But I know it today. Mori Rebbe, who was he married to? Tanya Levitt. Tanya Levitt was a descendant of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And that's the connection to Rav Chaim Meiser. Rav Chaim Meiser Grzynski's wife, the Vilna Rav's wife, was also a descendant of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, so that the Rebbetzin, Mori Rebbe's Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin Tanya, Dr. Tanya Soloveitchik, and Rebbetzin Grudzinski, they were cousins. And just as they're cousins, it ties right in with Roy Neuberger. So it's a beautiful story. A beautiful story. Now, there's something else here. After the Rebbetzin wrote her introduction, so Roy Neuberger wrote his introduction to the work. And he reveals everything over a quarter century ago when Larry and I decided to change our life. We entered a new world. We had grown up for 30 years as Americans, not Jews. I didn't know what challah was. I didn't even know what Yom Kippur was. I was 31 years old, the first time I ever saw talis and tefillin. And this is a very emotional experience that he describes. It impacted upon him. We were flying to Israel with Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis and a small group from her Hineni organization on the 11-hour flight from New York. If you leave late at night, they were on the El Al flight, the last flight. The men got up for morning prayers at about 4 a.m. New York time. I had been asleep. I awoke suddenly and saw men with little boxes on their heads. Had we landed on Mars? Maybe I was dreaming. Maybe I was waking up in another world. Actually, I was in another world. And here, this is a very, I've heard this from other people. People on an El Al plane, when suddenly they see people davening tefillin, they're Jews who don't know what tefillin are. And you see, he wakes up, he doesn't know where he is. He's on the plane, he sees tefillin, he's worried, who knows, maybe he's on Mars. He was in another world. He writes, I had no conception. And here was the Rebbetzin. What is a Rebbetzin anyway? Coming to tell us that we are descended from patriarchs, kings and prophets, great people who woke, great people who spoke to God. We should receive their legacy and continue their work. Now, there's something else that he writes about in the introduction that's very important, and it's also part of the great chasm in the Torah world today. And it's very insightful that he understands the uniqueness of the Rebbetzin's approach, and it impacts upon him. And I'll quote his words in a second, but let me paraphrase them. When we talk about Torah lifestyle, is there a single Torah lifestyle? And you see, is there a single Torah way of thinking, hashkafa, philosophy? And this gets involved with the whole question, for instance, Rav Shach introduced on the Israeli scene, the word they use is hashkafat tahora, that if you don't have a proper hashkafa, you're not a good Jew. And as a result, Agudat Yisrael split the Agudah and Degel HaTorah and Agudat Yisrael. Agudat Yisrael made Hasidic, Degel HaTorah Litvish. I need not tell you, then Shas split off, and you can go on and on, all the differences in Hasidic world and Yeshiva, and needless to say, the Mizrahi world. Who is right? Who is wrong? All right, there's some people who take the attitude there is one truth. In the outreach today, I'm not certain I'm correct, but I have a feeling that Or Sameach is more hardcore as far as outreach goes. It would seem to me a much more intelligent approach is there are many different ways to lead a Torah life. Hanoch l'na'a al pi dako. Each person has his own instincts, his own interests, his own emotion, his own intellectual. We don't have to force people into a straitjacket. In all my years of teaching, you all know, I'm a Litvak, but Baruch Hashem, I understand Hasidim, I understand all the shades of Hasidus, and you're free to have freedom of choice. No one can prove one derech is better than the other. If we could show that one derech is totally successful, I'd be the first one to line up. But you see what you have in the world. You have Satmar Chassidim running away from Satmar and writing books unorthodox. You have people running away from Beis Yaakov and becoming world famous through Netflix, right or wrong. I don't see any article on Aaron Rakefet Shayurim. And on this woman, I can't believe how much was written. Who the heck is she? She married a guy, threw away her Jewish husband. That's Yiddishkeit. That's what you boast about. But none of us are totally successful. We've given birth, all right. You have Chovevei Torah, you have within Chovevei Torah, divisions, subdivisions, etc., etc. I don't have to go on and describe. What Roy Neuberger sensed was so beautiful about the Rebbetzin is that her message was observance, absolutely, but hashkafa, multifaceted. Hanach, and he quotes her, Hanoch l'na al pi dako. Or in a classic Rebbetzin phrase, quote, God made the world in technicolor. The world is an orchestra. Some people play the first violin, some the second violin, some play the flute, some play the drums. And there is one conductor. All have an important part to play, although each one is different. If we each play our part correctly, the harmony is beautiful. And I think that's a very potent message that I personally totally agree with. I don't say everyone, again, I realize what's going on in the Torah world, but just this Saturday night, we have a minyan in my parking lot, Matzoy Shabbos, Matzoy Yontif. We always have a minyan in the parking lot. So from my building, it's just a few people who come. We even have people I'm not proud of, that they feel it's not right to daven in the parking lot. They have to go to shul, and we're in the middle of davening, and they walk out to climb up the hill, go to shul. I think it's a covet for the building that we have a minyan that attracts from the whole block around. We have 40, 50 people a block away. It's another minyan that emulates us in a parking lot. Not saying we're not reading Kriyas HaTorah, but it's a covet. You're in Israel, you're Jews, Atmat HaKodesh, a minyan in a parking lot, Motzoi Shabbos, wonderful. So we were talking about the Haredim and the Datiyim, and one guy is a college professor, I believe, but he's semi-Haredi, I'll call him, and he shouts at me, only the Haredim succeed in perpetuating Yiddishkeit. Well, I raised that question. Is that true? Only the Haredim succeed in perpetuating Yiddishkeit? Yomo shaking his head true. Long time. Yomo, thank God we had... Thank God we had Rabbi Revel in America introduce Talmudical Academy. Every yeshiva in America has a yeshiva high school. Yesterday I quoted to you what Gilmore told me, right? I quoted in class what Rav Shach said about the Rav. We all live in two worlds. We have no choice, and it's worse than ever due to the computer. It's a global village today, worse than ever. And we have to have the ability to live in two worlds, absolutely. Rav Shimshon Phil Hirsch served German Jewry. Thank God we have representatives here in class right in front of us. And what was before Rav Hirsch, what was in America, and everyone emulates quietly, slowly, the state of Israel, Baruch Hashem. Every day that goes by, Torah grows stronger and more pleasant and more colorful. And if you're smart, you have to be positive. We can't force everyone into a straitjacket. All right? I'm an example. The way I live, that's a Litvisha way. But there are others, Siddish, etc. Again, let me quote to you from Aaron Lichtenstein. Reb Aaron was asked, he was interviewed, it's a fabulous fart. Many, many years ago, when the world and Israel first discovered who Reb Aaron Lichtenstein is, they coined a new word in Hebrew. When he died, lo aleinu, to lose Reb Aaron is very sad. They coined a new word in Hebrew, hu haya outsider. Took me good many minutes to understand what that word was transliterated into Hebrew. They were developing the idea that although he was an outsider, when you're an outsider, you have no influence on the Israeli scene. I'm an outsider, all right? My daughter is an insider. There already you see the influence on the Israeli scene, wow, to the second power. But I'm an outsider. I'm here in YU. If I remained in Michala, it could be I would be an insider. But all right, I'm here. I'm an outsider. Baruch Hashem. And they said, even though he was an outsider, look at the impact he had on the Yeshiva Chesda. So they asked the Baron, how come you don't have a beard? How come you don't dress in black? Don't have a kapata, etc., etc.? And the Baron answered, ingenious. He said, tell me, we have in Israel Tzva Haganah Yisrael, right or wrong? We have the Mossad. Which is more important? No? Which is more important? Tzva Haganah Yisrael, they wear uniforms. Mossad? The last thing in the world they want to do is wear a uniform. Who worked for the Mossad in this room? New Year Motel de Class. Who worked for the Mossad? Thank you, thank you. I worked for the Mossad. My wife, could you picture me going to Russia, communist Russia, in a uniform? They would have kicked me out immediately. The work we did was only because we got lost in the crowd. At least we think we got lost in the crowd. It's not for now. I'll explain it some other time. Read Washington. Barack, which is more important? So the newspaper guy says to Reb Aaron, we need both. So he says, same thing. We need Rabbanim wear a uniform. We need Rabbanim without a uniform. We have to give people freedom of choice. And you see, the Newburgers were impressed. And there's a lot to be said for this. I hope in all my years of teaching, I have never maledicted anyone who doesn't think the way I do. At the end of the day, what? I know everything. I have the perfect answers. Baruch Hashem, I raised many good students and a wonderful family. Reb Aaron, when they asked him later in life, what was your greatest achievement? Remember what he answered? My family. And I love that answer. Charlie, you heard that? My family. That's what Reb Aaron answered. With all that he built and all that he influenced, my family. Baruch Hashem. So this is an introduction. We're just getting started. Now, what takes place in the Newburger world are two cities that become important. Cromwell, Connecticut, and Newburgh, New York. And why does Cromwell, Connecticut become famous? And here I'll summarize from the autobiography. They came from very well well-to-do families. The Neuberger family was involved in high finance, Wall Street investment. Linda's family was Valenci, and they were in furniture. As a matter of fact, I still remember as a kid, they were the Valenci furniture stores. It was a whole chain. And they did very well. So these were two well-to-do kids who fell in love at a young age, married. This is, by the way, to their credit, had a good marriage. And they're looking for Parnassa. And he winds up, and he admits everything with the help of his parents. He buys into a newspaper in Cromwell, Connecticut. And that newspaper provides the income. Newspapers can be very good income-wise in the sense it's a small, Cromwell, Connecticut, a town in Middlesex County. In the 2010 census, it had slightly over 14,000 people. So there was a paper that came out once a week, had many advertisements. The papers make their money from the advertisements. The truth being said, in Israel, many newspapers now are given out free. Yisrael Hayom started it. Maariv all week is free. And they tell you right away, they make their money from the advertisements. It's not that they're losing money. All right, Yisrael Hayom is endowed and financed by heavy money from Las Vegas. But the ads alone, B'Sheva, every Friday or every Thursday you get B'Sheva, it's a regular newspaper, wow. So they bought into Cromwell, Connecticut. This was their life. This is where they moved to. And this is what they put all their energy into. Now, Newburgh, New York is already a bigger city. It's a city in upstate New York. It was at one time a very important city because it's on the Hudson River. And when things were still shipped, when you had like Zim lines and all types of merchandise is being shipped upstate, so Newburgh became very important. It was one of the focal points where the ships would stop and deliver. Now, in the community, 6.5% of the faith community in Newburgh was Jewish. In other words, not everyone observed, not everyone believes, I don't have to tell you, but in the last survey done, the Catholic churches are very big. There's Protestant and there are Jews. And this was the synagogue in Newburgh that the Rebbetzin was invited to. My question hangs fire. What type of shul was it? What was going on? What was the turmoil? It would seem to me at the time they invited the Rebbetzin, it was Orthodox. Am I right?
I know there's an Orthodox shul there.
Today? Then it has to be this shul.
At one time, Daniel Kramer was the rabbi there.
Your son, right? Rabbi Dr. Daniel Kramer. We quoted him when we dealt with Torah Masorah in great depth. Okay. And it's still Orthodox today.
I haven't contacted that, I assume so.
Okay, no. Because when they say the shul is in turmoil, it may be at that time with the mechitza. In the early 70s, you could still have a problem, the mechitza. Do they want a mechitza? These people want to take it down, separate seating, but we don't want a mechitza. Other people said the mechitza is too small. I mean, this is a problem that could have been real, but he doesn't talk about what it meant to her. That shul was a stepping stone only to hear the Rebbetzin speak. And out of that shul came their whole thrust to the Rebbetzin, the family, the Zaidi. Their whole life becomes intertwined with Rebbetzin Jungreis. Okay. We've said that we have a lot more to do with the Neuberger family. I want you to see what the Rebbetzin said, what hit home with them. what was the message? And some of what we're going to quote becomes what I call quintessential Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis. It was said in Newburgh, it was said in the Madison Square Garden, it was said in the Hineni Center, it was said all over Israel, and it struck a very responsive chord. That's one part of it. There's the emotional part, how she was able to use the Holocaust so effectively. And the Rebbetzin, the personality, the class after the class, what we're going to see what happens, it's overwhelming to me because I lived it, I felt it, I know exactly the way she felt as a teacher. And when the class was over, you know, the mob scene would leave and the inner core would stay with her and discuss it further. They didn't want to leave her. It's the Gemara in Ma'at Katan, the Gemara in Chagiga, I should say, 100 times, 101 times, Eina Daima. It's very powerful. Okay, so let me reiterate what we've done so far today. Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis, go and believe, Shlomo, we were all kids in Bnei Akiva. The Rebbetzin was a short little lady, maybe 4'9". Her husband-to-be, who we knew as well from Bnei Akiva, Meshulam Halevi Jungreis, tall. Go and dream that these two little people that you knew from Bnei Akiva would wind up changing the world. You see, it's you have to have confidence, and I'll tell you a Devat Torah of Aaron Rakefet. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Hevi Noach l'shocheret." No one really knows what that means. Be nice to someone with a black head. Look, a black head there. Shlomo has a black head, okay? Well, be nice to him. Why should I be nice to him? Who the heck is he? What has he accomplished? What has he done? You don't understand. Hevi Noach l'shocheret. Today he's young. Who knows what he will accomplish 10, 20, 30 years from now? Who knows what he will develop into? Hevi Noach. Be decent. Be upright. Be nice. Be cordial. Got me? How do they say it in Wall Street? When you're rising to the top, be careful, because one day you may fall and you want those people to be nice to you when you fall. We don't have to go to falling. We just have to know, what do they say tomorrow at the Brit Milah of my new great-grandson? Zeh HaKatan Gadol Yehiyah. Okay? That's what it's about. And I look back at Bnei Akiva, imagine Yaakov Jungreis, Brudy Jungreis, Esther Jungreis, Meshulam Jungreis. Go and dream, one family. So to reiterate, we're trying to understand Esther, where she's coming from. We're trying to understand where she's going. The Newburghers serve as a wonderful introduction because they wrote a beautiful volume from Central Park to Sinai. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll pick up where we left off. We'll pick up with Roy and Linda Newberger, their description, their understanding. We'll get involved with Mark Wiener's most important moment in his young life when he attended the event at Madison Square Garden. We'll go into details about that. And we're going to deal with Israel. You'll see very fascinating material. And if I can end off by probing and bothering someone online on the screen, here you had it last week after class when we opened it to the world. Jay Solomon said, here's someone who grew up in Boston, went to Maimonides, knew the Rav intimately, And he said one of the greatest spiritual moments of his life when he was cutting out of New York between terms, all the kids and YU, I'm told, head down to Miami, head down to the beach, between terms, living a good, clean American life, beautiful. The sun, the heat, the winter, the beach, and there in Miami Beach, he heard Esther Jungreis speak in the Arthur Gottfried Theater, and that was one of the great spiritual moments in his life. So here, a guy knew the Rav intimately, and what does he talk about? That moment where Esther Jungreis reached his heart. Are there any questions from the wonderful students in front of me? Okay, next Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem, I'm going to be away for Shabbos. We're going away for Sheva Brachas, but I shouldn't have any problem. It's not that far from Yerushalayim, and we should be back in health and happiness to the second power. We pick up exactly where we left off with the concentration camp, with the tefillin, with the stamp, the Apollo stamp, and then we take on Yomo. Yomo versus Reb Moshe Feinstein, Yomo versus Reb Menashe Klein. Do we buy life insurance, or do we only say, Habotayach Bashem Chesed? Yisova Venhu. Thank you very much for honoring me with your presence, and if we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Yomo, open it to the world. Unmute. Are there any questions? Can you take away that in the middle so I can see? Any questions?
Really?
Yeah, go ahead.
You were in Newburgh years ago. The last I heard, they had moved to Lawrence. I think I saw them about 10, 12 years ago at a Young Israel National Council dinner. They once invited me over, but I don't think we ever got together.
One second. Which Jungreis did you know?
I knew Roy Neuberger.
Oh, Roy and Linda Neuberger.
Roy and Linda, right? Israel and Leah. I saw them last, I think, at a Young Israel National Council dinner around 12 years ago or something like that.
Okay.
As far as I knew, Newburgh, New York, in the Hudson Valley, has one Orthodox shul still. I knew people in the shul, and I think I knew people who were Rabbanim and Balei Kriya there. I should ask Rav Daniel Kramer, but who else can also tell you? Rav Eliezer Langer had a shelter in Poughkeepsie.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that Orthodox shul has to be the shul that changes his life. Okay, we'll get to that next week.
There's only one. There was somebody once, he was related to someone, and I was at a chasna once, and there was someone who lived in either Newburgh or Poughkeepsie, I don't remember.
Okay, that answers the question. That has to be the shul, and it has to be an Orthodox shul, which makes sense. And that's why they invited the Rebbetzin. But what did they mean, the shul is in turmoil? That we still have a question mark. What was the turmoil about?
Not if that you want, I'll ask one of them.
No, ask. Other Rabbi. Other Rabbi.
We can find out.
Other Rabbi.
Rabbi Langer used to come onto the shir once in a while.
Rabbi Lazer Langer, Larry Langer would come onto the shir. I don't see him now, but I don't know if I see everyone either. Also, I find it hard.
He's not on now.
It's little.
I remember when he was in San Diego.
Right. Correct.
And I saw him at YU commencement a couple of years ago when he was in Poughkeepsie.
And he was in Austin, Texas as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Austin has the shul that was moved where they moved the building. It was an old building, years, with no community left. They moved it a couple of hundred miles onto the Dell campus.
Wow.
Dell is big in Austin.
And to move a building is not a simple matter, but Baruch Hashem.
There are no restrooms in the building. There's a separate building next to it with the restrooms. The shul that was moved has a balcony. It's a two-story shul that was moved.
Wow. As I recall, when I met him in Austin, the shul where they davened was part of the communal center. It wasn't a building unto itself. They were given room.
That sounds like it, because the Dell campus has the JCC in it.
Okay, so that's it.
The Dell computers is very big in that area.
Okay, that's the answer. All I can tell you is Austin University, tremendous campus. And the entire university is surrounded by one saloon after another. And Malka and I got a tour with the Cohn family, Rabbi Danny Cohn and his wonderful wife Merrill, and we couldn't believe what we saw. If any student there learns anything outside of learning how to drink good liquor, I would be very surprised.
And the buildings, like the bus station, have a sign outside not to bring in firearms.
Okay. I can understand. Anyone else have a question? Anyone else? Okay. No, Jack is just covering his mouth. But Baruch Hashem. All right, I want to thank everyone who joined me from across the world. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Thank you very, very much.